We talk a lot on this podcast about chess improvement, but when it comes to improving your hiring processes, Indeed is the platform you need. Indeed has over 350 million global monthly visitors, and it has a matching engine that helps you find quality work candidates fast. You can use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with your candidates faster. And Indeed doesn't just help you hire faster. 93% of employers agree that Indeed delivers the highest quality matches compared to other job sites, according to a recent Indeed survey. Years ago, when I was running a chess teaching business, I found it hard to find good help, and I had to go through a lot of back and forth to even screen potential candidates. Indeed allows you to do those things efficiently in one place. Indeed's matching engine is constantly learning from your preferences, so the more you use Indeed for hiring, the better it gets. Join more than 3.5 million businesses worldwide that use Indeed to hire great talent fast. And listeners of Perpetual Chess will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility if you go to Indeed.com/chess. Just go to Indeed.com/chess right now, and you'll be supporting our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast, Indeed.com/chess. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
It's only a kick. A jump. A block. It's only a serve. It's only a tackle. A run. It's only for the fans. After all, it's only pressure. You got this. Adidas.
Why take one vacation with the family when you could take all of them? With Royal Caribbean, you don't just go to the beach. You visit a private island and race down the tallest water slide in North America. You don't just go for a road trip. You ATV and zip line through the jungle. You don't just go somewhere new. You rappel down waterfalls and discover ancient temples. Because this isn't just any vacation. This is all the vacations. Come seek the Royal Caribbean. Ships Registry, Bahamas.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to Perpetual Chess. Listeners, I am very excited for our interview this week, and we will be introducing our guests in one moment, but did want to give a shout out to our presenting chess education sponsors, chessable.com. They've got some great looking new courses, including Tactical Vision for Beginners by Grandmaster Sam Shanklin. Shanklin, of course, is very well reviewed, both as a book author and a Chessable author, in addition to being an amazing player. So it's exciting that he is doing something a little bit geared more towards beginners than his other works. There's also tons of new opening courses, including one on the Alapin Sicilian, one on the Classical Sicilian by renowned trainer, Grandmaster Srinath. And there's just so many more. So be sure to always take a look at what Chessable has to offer. And if you sign up for Chessable Pro using the link in the show description, it will help to support Perpetual Chess. And you will also get discounts on courses and other types of goodies. As for our guest this week, I've been preparing for this one for a while. He's written some incredible books. He is also a two-time Dutch champion, a many-time Olympian, I think it's 11. He turned into, in later years, a meditation teacher. For many years, he was a renowned opening theoretician who edited the New in Chess yearbooks and also wrote the fantastic and popular opening encyclopedia, Fundamental Chess Openings. The occasion of this particular interview is two books that are now widely available or will be shortly by the time this comes out. Number one is a chess memoir slash game collection called In Black and White. It was originally published in Dutch in 2011, but was recently translated to English by New in Chess. Like I said, soon it will be available everywhere. You can already get it on Forward Chess. It's a detailed and honest chess memoir. It gives a blow-by-blow of his career from beginnings all the way through. Plenty of both chess and life details. And in the forthcoming issue of New in Chess, in his book review section, Grandmaster Matthew Sadler wrote, quote, "I think it's simply the finest chess book I've ever read." I read it too, and I also thought it was absolutely fantastic. So I'm excited to discuss that one. But he also has a brand new book called Mindful Chess. After Paul retired from professional chess, he got heavily into meditation, going on many retreats and even became a meditation teacher. And this book is a concise look back at what he learned from chess, from meditating, and how he thinks the two relates. So we've got plenty to discuss, and I'm honored to welcome to the program Grandmaster Paul van der Steren. Welcome, Paul.
Thank you very much. Glad to be here.
Yeah, excited to chat. Oh, and I forgot one more detail. You are the chairman of the Max Orwaith Center, which we will also be discussing there in historic Amsterdam. But Paul, there's so much to dig into. I've read and greatly enjoyed both of your books, and obviously they're different books, one being sort of like a meditation, a sort of big picture look at both chess and mindfulness and how they relate. But then in Black and White, this broad sweep look at your career that traces both its peaks and valleys and a sort of slow decision that chess was not captivating you as much as it used to. As I said, greatly enjoyed it. But I thought we might start with what most consider to be the highlight of your career. At age 37, 1993, you had this incredible year. You won the Dutch Championship for the second time in, you know, smashing fashion, basically, won clear of the field and qualified for the candidates for the only time you would in your career. And a lot of people listening, most of us are amateur chess players, but we're hoping to have breakthroughs too. And obviously you write about this at length in your book, but sitting here right now, you know, more than 10 years after you wrote that book, what do you think happened in 1993?
Well, this is perhaps one thing I discovered when I wrote the book, that these things are really inexplainable. I don't know what happened. It's a real mystery to me as well. Of course, it's very attractive to tell yourself, well, of course I had this fantastic result because I'm a great player. So naturally, I should have a success like this at least once in my life. But that's just fooling yourself. I really don't know what happened. Probably it had something to do with a very bad year I had before that. In 1992, I had quite a few disasters, real disasters. I mean, result-wise in my tournaments. What I found, what I think I found during the period I wrote this book is that it's a natural up and down movement. And so you somehow, your mind or my mind, but I'm pretty sure this is goes for everybody, just goes up and then goes down again. And after the very bad results I had in 1992, I was simply due for a great up. And, of course, that it would be such a wonderful up and over a very long period of time, I couldn't foresee that at all. But that's, let's say, if we're looking for rational explanations, then I should say it's the natural movement of the mind to go up and then go down again, then go up, then go down again. This is what I found over my complete career from about 1970 to 2000.
And you wrote in your book that you, even at that time, you sort of felt like this may be the peak. What do you think gave you that perspective? Whereas I feel like a lot of people, even after all those ups and downs, as you describe, a lot of people might think, oh, I've broken through to a new level. But, mm-hmm. but you, it seemed like you were a little more modest at that point.
Yeah, I'm not sure if it's a question of being modest. I did feel that I had broken through to a level where I hadn't been before. I never went back, I think, to being the Paul van der Sterren before 1993. But I think I also knew what was coming, which was a dip down again. So I was, of course, a bit disappointed when things started to go downhill. But by then I had... I was fully convinced that this was the natural course of events and that this up and down flow was also what I had to thank for, that I went up so high in 1993. But each time I was on a high like that, I never came back to the old level. It was always a gradual movement up until, of course, it became a gradual movement down, which happened a few years after that.
Right. And you wrote in the book that you didn't even want to mention this at the time because you felt like maybe it's not perceived as something real, but you felt like buying a new house and moving may have contributed to your success in that year.
Yes. I mentioned in the book that this is something I never discussed with other chess players because they just wouldn't believe me or they wouldn't want to hear this. But external circumstances have a very great influence on your performance as a chess player. And I think what helped me enormously was that I moved house in 1993, which by force cleared my mind from everything else for a period of several weeks. And I think this did me a lot of good. So this helped. This was between the Dutch Championship and the Interzonal Tournament in Biel, where I qualified for the candidates. It was in between two very good tournaments, but it did certainly help me to take my mind off chess, in a way to relax. Although moving house isn't in itself a relaxing event, but it relaxed my mind from chess completely. So yes, I'm pretty sure that this maybe was a decisive factor, in fact. But this is, of course, something you can't plan. This is something you only reflect on afterwards. You can't say, okay, I'm going to play a great Tata Steel tournament, so I'm going to move house first in December. That's not the way it works.
Yeah, although there is something... picking up on your work on mindfulness, there's something about sort of like the act of letting go, you know, the act of not caring as much because you're distracted may lead to a higher high. And of course, in the candidates match, you played a young star, Gata Komski.
Yeah.
You lost that match. The score indicates it's not that close, but when you go through the games and relive the emotions with you in the book, it was close.
Yes,
it was. What are your memories looking back at that match?
Well, first, I immediately knew that I didn't have that level anymore of the summer of 1993. But still, I think I had a very decent level and I was playing pretty good. It must have been something mental. I lost the match because there were two games where I was winning. One I was just completely winning and the other I was also fairly winning. Two games which I lost both by huge one-move blunders. And I think it was that weakness which had come back. I mean, I throughout my career, I've always been prone to making blunders. In the summer of 1993, this was completely absent, never happened. But when I played Komski in January 1994, this weakness had reestablished itself in my mind. And that's what caused me to lose the match. I think I played pretty well, apart from the fact that I made two really bad blunders, and you can't do that, of course. Giving 2 points away in a short match like that is just too much.
Yeah, and if memory serves, you blundered away the first game, but then you came back and won, and then basically repeated the cycle.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah,
And then I lost.
Well, it's good that you did those things.
Sorry?
Yeah. And then it was over.
Almost.
But you make it more. You make it more relatable for us amateur players by doing that.
Yes. Well, basically, I mean, a mind of a top player works exactly the same way as an amateur player. That's why I think this is a universal process, that you have ups and then necessarily you have a down again and then up and down again. Maybe what distinguished me from many amateur players is that I could live with that. You know, I didn't give up. It's so easy, and I see. I've always seen a lot of very talented young players simply give up on chess because they can't deal with the disappointments. And there will always be disappointments, and that's unavoidable. I mean, even Magnus Carlsen has had to work his way through many disappointments. And what distinguishes, I think, top players from lesser players is that they simply don't care. They take these disappointments and they carry on.
And you feel like that was generally a strength of yours?
I think so, yes. I think so. I've had so many disappointments. If I wouldn't have been able to deal with them, I'd have given up on chess when I was about 25 or something. Then when I still could have chosen another career in my life. And that's what many very right. talented young players do. They are very good as juniors. They're very good in their 20s. And then when they're still young enough to choose a different career, they quit chess and do something more stable. Mentally stable.
Yeah, and you write about that push and pull a lot. Obviously, yeah. Ultimately, finally retiring at 45 and becoming a meditation teacher. Were there any periods in your earlier years where you were close to pursuing a different career?
Well, I think I was, but at the age of about 22, 23, I think I was fairly set on my chess career, maybe a little bit later, 25. But when you're young, I think there are moments of doubt. I mean, there's always pressure from other people, my parents, for instance. I mean, they were pretty relaxed about my choosing a professional chess career, but still, they were probably hoping for some years that I would become a decent lawyer or something. So, yes, especially when I was young, there were some moments. But, at some point you just choose and then you don't look back.
Yeah, although you do look back, luckily for us, because we got to read this book.
Well, it's very interesting.
Returning to... Sorry, go ahead.
Yeah. Well, I was
going to say
that when I stopped playing tournaments, when I stopped playing chess professionally, it's sort of suddenly happened to me that I started to enjoy writing books. So I wrote the Dutch version of Fundamental Chess Openings. And then I simply, to my own surprise, discovered that this in a way replaced playing chess, not in all ways, of course, but in that I took a lot of pleasure from writing. And then I naturally continued to write. After that, I wrote the English version, which became Fundamental Chess Openings. After that, I started on this autobiography, Zwart op Wit in Dutch, which is now in black and white. And it was just very, very surprising and satisfying to discover that a lot of the pleasure I playing chess had given me was now available to me through writing. So in a very different way, it gives me much pleasure to do this creative thing, which is called writing.
Yeah, and again, incredible works, and I want to discuss all of them. Now, on the topic of in black and white, one of the many things that struck me was your absolutely incredible recall of events and tournaments going all the way back to your childhood. So I was curious, Paul, if did you take notes? Were you keeping a diary? Like, or was you able to remember everything as you went through the games?
Yeah, this helped me enormously. I have kept diaries for large periods of my life, not always, but very long periods. I have always collected paper clippings of, you know, I'm not quite sure if this is, it's probably not the same in America, but in Holland, chess was really very, very popular. It still is, but it was widely written about in newspapers during the 70s, 80s, 90s, my time. So I have a lot of paper of clippings of my own tournaments, which helps my memory enormously. And then, of course, I also made notes. I always made notes of my games, and sometimes I wrote little texts about how I experienced certain tournaments. So, yes, I had a lot of notes to base my book upon, and this helped my memory enormously. I think without those, it would have been a much flatter book.
Yeah, it's a good lesson for everyone listening and for myself, that the value of keeping notes and diarying. You never know when you might want to return to those things. And we should say for listeners, one thing I appreciated is that New in Chess, you and the team made a decision not to just inject all of your analysis with engine lines here in, well, probably done in 2023, but here we are in 2024, but just preserved your thoughts as they were shared in sort of a classical way. That made it much more enjoyable to me.
Yeah. Well, I'm glad you take that point of view. I really appreciate that. Well, the whole idea of the book is to express how I reflected on my chess career. And I thought it's just much more in line with that philosophy to not make new analysis with engines and to just restrict myself to what I thought about my games in 1970, in 1980, in 1990, the thoughts about my games when I played them. I didn't think it was an addition to those memories to reflect on them with engines. Anybody can use the engines for themselves if they look at my games. So this is not something that the book provides, and I think it would make it a very different book if I had used engines.
Yeah, well said. In returning to the topic of memory, so you mentioned you were helped a lot by all the notes and journaling that you did. I'm just curious, because we've been talking recently on the pod, I've interviewed a couple cognitive scientists and been talking about, you know, how adults can help their own memories. So I'm curious if your notes were something, and reviewing your games was something that you did periodically over the years, or was it more like you set it aside and didn't look at it until you were sitting down to write in black and white?
Well, keeping a diary is something which forces you to reflect on whatever has happened to you. So that was certainly, let's say, a proto-autobiography in a way. But during my career, I never had the idea that I would write an autobiography like this. This just happened when I had finished playing and when I had the time. I mean, when you're a professional chess player, you're working on chess all the time. You can write short articles, short pieces of analysis, but a large project, writing a book, there's very few chess players who find the time to do that. So when I suddenly had all this time available after I quit chess, As I said, I started to enjoy writing.
But not as much reflection during your career.
Yeah, there was always reflection. There was always reflection. Yeah.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
And so Matthew Sadler writes an absolutely glowing review. Again, rightfully so. I also love this book. But from Matthew's perspective, I can see Matthew, of course, one of England's top players, was a bright talent and actually decided to pursue a career in IT. And you makes a brief appearance in your book. You guys played in his younger years. But I sense from his review that it was like the road not traveled for him. So it was like an additional, he knows all the principles, but also it's like what could have been. You guys, both very accomplished players, and he went down a different path. So I think for him, based on what he wrote, that level, that added an additional level of sort of identification with the book. But for me, as a 47-year-old, 2100 non-professional, I still identified greatly with the book because to me, it was almost a story about aging generally. Like there's tons of chess and it's fun to play through the games and see how your game evolved and see all the great players that you played over the years. But this slow reckoning with losing your passion for something and with your skills gradually declining, I think is something that's relatable even beyond the chessboard. So I'm curious, Paul, if you had these sort of big themes in mind when you were writing the book, or was it more just that's the chronicle and that's what played out in your life?
Yes, the latter, I think. When I was writing the book, I probably was a bit surprised myself that there was so much reflection on aging and declining in strength. And I must have realized at some point that this was actually the theme of the second part of the book, or the last part of the book, that aging and declining is a completely natural human process, of course, but for chess players, it makes such a big difference whether you're young and growing or aging and declining in your mental powers and physical powers. So for me, it was probably also a discovery that this was actually a very natural human process, one which every chess player, like every other human being, has to deal with. And it probably gave me a lot of satisfaction to find that I had dealt with it so well that I hadn't, let's say, gone mad or become very depressed or dropped in a black hole. This is, of course, also where meditation came in. I started doing meditation in 98 when I was 42, and I was already in a process of decline, though not very steep decline. I mean, I remained a fairly good player until the end. But meditation probably helped me enormously to just let it happen, this process of aging and declining. And sort of distancing myself from the chess player I used to be. This is also like the 1993 peak in my performances. This is also something which is very mysterious and which you can rationalize about, but it's really not quite possible to fully understand these things. But I'm quite sure that the meditation I did helped me to accept the way things were going and to just let it be, to not try to be cleverer than life itself, to just let it happen. And that's
one moment that...
Yeah. Sorry, go ahead. No, go on. Sorry.
I was I was just going to say one moment that was illustrative for me was in 1998 when you were annotating your game with Grandmaster Mikhail Krasenko. You didn't fight as hard at the end, and you write that at that moment, declining perseverance is becoming my Achilles, was becoming my Achilles heel.
Yeah.
And there's this famous story. I interviewed this author, Sasha Chapin, wrote a fun little chess memoir from an amateur's perspective. And he, one of the principals in the character was Ben Feingold. I'm gonna spoil this for listeners who haven't heard my interview with Sasha or read the book, All the Moves That Matter. It's a fun book. But he teases at the beginning, like, there's a secret to chess that Ben Feingold told him. And obviously, he does, like, the big reveal at the end. So I'm going to reveal the secret for listeners who haven't read this year-old book. But Ben in that book says, the secret is you have to play like you don't want the games to end. Which, when you wrote about how in your game against Krasenko, you just couldn't quite fight as hard as as you used to. I made that connection and can relate to it myself at some level. So you mentioned this idea of acceptance from your mindfulness practice. Was it a process for you to accept something like that? Like, were you mad at yourself, or were you deep enough into meditation where you accepted it all the way?
No, it was definitely a process. I think first you discover that powers like these are slowly declining, the perseverance, which you are talking about now. And then gradually the acceptance just happens. And at some point you just know that you don't have the perseverance anymore that was natural to you when you were still 20. And yes, you accept and you know that you are losing things. You know that you are becoming weaker in many ways. And you also, what I find out is that you can still play at a decent level. But you, at the same time, you know that this is only going one way, and that is down. So yes, that's why in the end I decided to quit, because I had lost the love of the game. I think at one moment it became too one-dimensional for me, and I just when I felt I couldn't enjoy playing chess anymore, that was probably the moment, or the limit. I knew that my time was up.
Makes sense. We'll be right back with more from Grandmaster Paul van der Stern.
Kingdom of the Planet of the Apes is coming to IMAX and theaters everywhere.
What a wonderful day!
This summer, one movie event will reign.
It is our time.
They stole my village.
I know where they're taking your clan.
Bend for your king.
Never.
Kingdom of the Planet of the Apes, only in theaters May 10th. Tickets on sale now. Rated PG-13. Some material may be inappropriate for children under 13.
Why take one vacation with the family when you could take all of them? With Royal Caribbean, you don't just go to the beach. You visit a private island and race down the tallest water slide in North America. You don't just go for a road trip. You ATV and zip line through the jungle. You don't just go somewhere new. You rappel down waterfalls and discover ancient temples. Because this isn't just any vacation. This is all the vacations. Come seek the Royal Caribbean. Ships Registry, Bahamas.
Your brain needs support, and new Ollie Brainy Chews are a delightful way to take care of your cognitive health. Made with scientifically backed ingredients like Thai ginger, L-theanine, and caffeine, Brainy Chews support healthy brain function and help you find your focus, stay chill, or get energized. Be kind to your mind and get these nootropic chews at Ollie.com. That's OLLY.com. These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease.
And we are back. And we have a question from a listener of the podcast. This is from Brian Karen, who founded the chess book or sorry, the Facebook chess book collectors group. They have something like 40,000 plus members that I know there've been some comments, people excited for your book, for the translation of Chess in Black and White, which again, it's available on Forward Chess now. I think for the physical copy, it's probably going to be a slower rollout in the coming months from when this is heard. It's a, Benjamin's is a fantastic book, but it's very long. It can keep listeners busy for a long time. So yeah. If you, for me, I would recommend getting it in digital format just because there's tons and tons of games and because it's very long. But if you like a beautiful, thick book, you can wait for that as well. Anyway, so Ryan's question relates to this because you're talking about accepting decline, and his relates to something that us amateurs struggle with a lot, which is why they either decline or might struggle to get better. So Brian asks, he says, broadly speaking, adult improvers face two hurdles. Number one, it could be intrinsic. As a person gets older, there's cognitive decline and other genetic age-related problems. Mm-hmm. Number two, external. Adults are busier than children and have less time for study, play. They face psychological burdens. For example, if a child has a poor tournament, it's a learning experience. If an adult has one, he wonders if he's slipping, so it can become a self-fulfilling prophecy. Yeah. So he'd like to hear your opinion, if you could describe what you feel is the more predominant problem and what, if anything, can be done to deal with these problems.
Well, I think both aspects that he mentions are very real. It's a very difficult question, and no one has written a manual for that. I know of no books who teach you to keep your level or improve your level as an adult. I can only say that the crucial element is, do you still enjoy chess? If you manage to play or do something with chess in a matter in a way which is still enjoyable to you, then you are doing the right thing. If it's a matter of trying to stop the decline, just trying to stop it and nothing else, then, well, I would say this is in the long run pretty hopeless. But of course, I wish anyone good luck who tries to avoid the unavoidable. But if I look at myself, you know, I enjoy chess enormously now that I don't play it anymore. Now I am back, I never was a real amateur. I'm just a real chess lover now. I enjoy following tournaments online, especially the elite tournaments, Carlsen, who is, and all his rivals. When they are playing, I'm always trying to follow the games. And writing about chess also gives me a lot of pleasure. So I really enjoy chess enormously. Now I don't play anymore. Of course, I don't want to recommend everybody who is trying to improve as an adult to stop playing and just look at games, follow games. But this is what has worked for me to release the pressure that of having to perform and to just go back to that simple point where you once began, the fascination for chess itself, the love of the game, that has not declined at all in me. And I think most people who have problems keeping their chess level as an adult or even trying to improve it should probably not focus too much on the on getting better results, but on I think they should focus on how do I still enjoy, what do I still enjoy in chess? Is it the playing? Is it the improving my Elo rating? Or is it the game itself, which I still enjoy? And if it's the latter, if it's the game itself, the game of chess, which you still enjoy, then maybe you should look for other ways to enjoy it, and not non-competitive ways.
Wise advice, unsurprisingly. Yeah, I find it very relatable because personally, I go back and forth when I play competitively. I wonder, am I enjoying this? I don't know. Some days I feel like I am. Some days I feel like I am not.
Yeah.
I do feel like in the final analysis, it's good for me is what keeps me coming back. I've mentioned this before, but I get distracted by my phone, and I feel like I have a harder time focusing, both as the years go on and as technology progresses. And chess is the one thing something that used to be a strength of mine, I'm still able to bring back. So that's what keeps me going back to competing. Okay. But I'm curious, Paul, from your perspective, you talk a lot about sort of acceptance and letting go and these mindfulness sort of themes that come across. Did you think about continuing to play and just trying to totally disassociate yourself from results? Or do you think as a professional who's accomplished as much as you have, that it's uniquely challenging?
I tried to go back to chess in a small way. I went back to playing club matches for my Amsterdam club. And this I did for 7 years. I just played these club matches, nothing else. And that I did to try and find out, do I still enjoy this? And then I had the same experience that you are describing just now. At some moments I enjoyed it, then I didn't enjoy it at all. But it was a nice experiment to see if I could still go back to being a player. This, of course, was not professional. I didn't earn any money with this at all. This was just amateur chess. But I did try to play at my best level. And, it was a nice experiment. But after 7 years, which was, it sounds impressive as if 7 years, but this was probably just 50 games or so, I stopped again. At that point, I definitely knew that this was now a thing of the past, playing chess myself. I didn't enjoy it anymore. But it was a nice experiment, and I'm glad to have done it. By the way, you said something just now which triggered me. I'm not quite sure what it was, but I'd like to add to our previous topic that playing chess or watching chess. So if you watch chess, you are still playing chess in your mind. So you're still using your brain right. cells actively. And I think whether you play or just watch chess, this is a very good anti-aging method as well. I mean, it's a slightly different subject from trying to be an adult improver. But in general, I think as long as you can enjoy chess and play mentally, use these brain cells, it's probably an excellent anti-aging program. Sorry for the
diversion. I agree with that. And that is... No, that's one of the things that I always keep in the positive ledger, and that keeps me going back for now at least. Paul, I want to switch gears and discuss mindful chess a bit. So just to give listeners a bit of an overview, comparing again, you've written obviously much more than these two books, but these two are newly available in the English language. So In Black and White, sprawling, beautiful chess memoir. You could spend a year reading it and going through the games easily. And Mindful Chess, very maybe one or two diagrams, but not very much chess in it, although certainly plenty of mentions of chess. And you could read it in 2 days easily. It's much sort of lighter book. And I'd like to dig into it. But I think to set the stage, maybe you should tell the story of, first of all, we have a lot of American listeners, so they might be interested in hearing about your attending the New York Open in 1995 and picking up a book that set you on this whole path.
Yes, well, actually, it wasn't the start of my interest in meditation and philosophy, but it was a very important moment when I played the New York Open in 1995. As you probably know, this is a very tough tournament with several games a day and many strong players, and you have to play your very best to keep the winning a prize within your reach. It's very easy to lose one game and then you don't have any chance at all anymore. So I was completely focused during these 4 days, I think, on the chess and everything I could do to keep myself as fit as possible. And always between games, I just lay on my bed and emptied my mind completely. But what I always did before that was reading a few lines from the Bhagavad Gita, which was a book I had bought in New York, actually, just before the tournament started. I chose it because it was the smallest book available in the bookshop, but it turned out to be a fantastic choice. And just reading a few lines was always enough for the chess to completely disappear from my mind, between games, I mean, and to be able me to be able to for me to make a fresh start for the next game. So it was quite a wonderful experience. Also, very hard to explain, sort of the soothing effect this book had on me. But definitely after that, I knew I had to pursue this to this, let's say, this study of Eastern wisdom, of Hinduism, Buddhism, Taoism, etc. And a few years after that, I started to meditate. In fact, then it really became, let's say, physical. Up to then, it had been an intellectual study, but when I started to meditate, it turned physical. It became not just something my mind was occupied in, but my whole body.
Yeah, and you didn't just get casually into it, as you write in the book. No. You started going to these meditation retreats,
yeah,
where you would have very little sensory input for a week, 10 days. Yeah. And I've meditated here and there, but never at that level. And I was just curious, because to me, there's something maximalist about it. What do you think it was about your interest that said, I'm not going to do this for 20 minutes a day or an hour a day. I'm going to go do this for a week straight. What led to that?
Oh, maybe I'm naturally a perfectionist. That's one explanation. But I also think I had intellectually studied these things so deeply that I understood that you have to go into this completely. And that if you don't, then it's simply not, it doesn't have the power that it is supposed to have. So it just became clear to me that I had to go into this all out. And then soon enough, you feel that it is working on you, for better or worse, because you experience a lot of pain in these retreats. It's not pleasant at all.
Right.
But you do get the idea that you're on the right track, in the sense that it's really going somewhere, and that is probably what kept me going. That I knew I got onto a path, you could say, which had a purpose. It wasn't just a play. It was for real. It really was life changing. That's what I felt, probably, that if you do this seriously, then it can change your life, and it did.
Yeah, It's an interesting dichotomy, though, this idea that you wrote in the book, as you just alluded to, you say, quote, the first meditation retreat was hell. Yeah. So it's not something where when you read it, you say, oh, I'm going to go do this meditation retreat. But then you also write about its life-changing positive impact. And of course, you write about this in the book, too. But what general advice might you give for a chess player, pros and cons of taking up meditation?
Well, there's a lot of very different, very, there's so many, such a variety of meditation forms. I think if a chess player wants to improve, he will naturally start thinking about improving his mental health, his mental attitude, his mental toughness. And if you're really serious about improving your mental health or state of mind, then meditation is just a very interesting tool to try. And I tried, and this eventually led me to give up chess, but that's probably because I was already 45 years of age, and it was a natural moment for me to quit chess. I think younger players would probably find meditation very restful for them. And in fact, some players, modern players, young modern players like Gukesh from India, Prajnananda, and others from this generation, they come from a culture, India, where meditation is very natural and completely accepted and not regarded as something bizarre. And I think they already practice meditation. They have spoken about this in interviews. And for them, it's a very natural tool to keep yourself mentally fit and healthy, even during the pressure of playing high-level chess. So, yes, I would recommend people who are considering to start meditation, chess players who are considering starting meditation, to just try and give it a go. To find a meditation center somewhere and simply try. You will find out soon enough whether it helps you or whether it destroys you as a chess player.
Right. And you write in Mindful Chess that mindfulness may or may not benefit your chess, but it will benefit you as a human.
That's what
I agree with that.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. And I agree with that.
I'm saying it isn't helpful for your chess because mindfulness is not the same thing as concentration. And what you need as a chess player is as deep a concentration as possible. Mindful chess is not really geared towards deepening your concentration. It can be a side effect, but it's not the purpose of the meditation. First, there are many other forms of meditation that are geared towards improving your concentration. And second, the much more important effect, I think, is what it has on you as a human being. After all, even a chess player is a human being. And I think in the end, the human being always comes first.
Again, well said. We'll be right back with more from Grandmaster Paul van der Stern.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
And we are back. And we have one more question from a listener. This one is from David Hamm. David, thank you for helping support Perpetual Chess via Patreon. And David asks, he says, I've recently been spending a more significant portion of my chess training time on the mental aspect of the game. I've identified several books in the general sports psychology space that I'm planning on working through. However, I haven't found a lot of resources directly focused on chess in that space. The only book I was able to find is Mental Toughness in Chess by Werner Schweitzer. I'm about halfway through that book and it's okay. But given your focus in the area, do you have more or better resources that directly connect sports psychology concepts with the sport of chess?
Well, this is a very good question, actually. And no, there's simply nothing good about that aspect of chess, I think. I know of no books which could help you. I would suggest exactly what you have already been doing. Read books which deal with sports psychology in general. It would be great if there were books on specifically on chess, but I don't know of any of them. The book that you mentioned, I don't know. I hope it will help you. But yes, this is actually an area in chess literature which has yet to be filled. I might write a book on it myself, actually, now that you mention it.
We would love that. That would be great. I mean, I do feel like mindful chess, it touches on it in a sense, I do think it's fertile ground. And I noticed that you make references to cycling a few times, obviously very popular in the Netherlands. Yeah. Are there any books that stand out about cycling that you found helpful or applicable to chess?
Not exactly to chess, but maybe to the effect cycling can have on your mind. There's a very famous Dutch writer, Tim Krabbe, who has written a book, The Cyclist. I'm pretty sure it's has been translated into English and many other languages because it's really a phenomenal book. And he is also a chess player.
I think it's called The Rider in English.
Ah, okay, yes.
Yeah, I interviewed him. He's a fantastic writer. But I think it's called The Rider in English. Yeah, yes. He's a living treasure. He's
fantastic. And he also used to be a very good chess player. So he does actually compare cycling to chess at some point in his book. And this book stimulated me to take up cycling myself. When I had read this book, I bought a racing bike and started doing rides in the country. Did this for several years, which helped me also to keep my physical condition at a reasonable level. But yes, you have to look at other forms of literature to help you in this respect. Yes, my mindful chess, perhaps. Also, other books which touch more about the psychology of chess. There's also this fantastic book by Genna Sezonko, The Essential Sezonko, where he writes about the human beings behind the chess players, the famous Russian chess players that he has known. I think this also might help you a little bit in understanding the chess psychology and the human side of being a chess player. But yes, you have to look at the fringes of chess literature. There is simply no no standard manual, unfortunately.
Yeah. Yeah, the Essential Sezonko is a wonderful book. And of course, Sezonko, one of the many players who makes many appearances over the board against you in black and white, which brings me to the next topic. I mean, you've played so many legends. So I'd just love to hear a few memories about some of the players who make brief appearances in your book. For example, you played the Polgar sisters and I believe it was Vikanze. In the B section, in their teenage years, what are your memories of those young Polgars?
Well, first of all, amazement at their being so special. The first to emerge was the oldest, of course, Souza. I met her for the first time, I think, in London in 1981. She must have been 12 or perhaps 11 then. And she was not participating in this tournament where I played, but she was playing Blitz with an American grandmaster, actually, John Fedorovich, a contemporary of mine, who was a very good player. And she was just crushing him. So this was my first experience of what the polka of polka strength. Then 1 or 2 years afterwards, a good friend of mine paid a visit to Budapest to the polkas, and he came back with stories about there being two younger sisters who were even better than Susa. And I just didn't believe him. I thought he was pulling my leg. And when I first met Sofia and Judith, especially Judith, of course, turned out to be even better than Susa indeed. And she was just a phenomenon in those first years. Yes, this tournament that you mentioned in Wijkaanzee in 1990, I think. And all three sisters played in the B section, which was a grandmaster tournament, but not as quite as strong as the A section. And they did extremely well. And I lost to both Judith and Sofia. I was very lucky to get a draw against Susa. But I wasn't the person who did worst against them. Luc van Wely, for instance, who was young at the time, but already a very good player, he lost to all three of the sisters. And after that, yes, of course, they never looked back. It's been a wonderful period in the history of chess, actually, when they played, when they were all active and all having their own successes. It was quite a unique period of in the chess history. I'm really quite glad to have lived through this period, although it cost me a lot of games. I think I lost to Judith three times, to Sofia once, I think. Only against Susa, I could sort of keep the balance. Maybe I beat her once and a couple of draws. But yes, they were really pretty special. And they still are, but of course, they're not like these players anymore.
Yeah. I'll read a quote from your notes to the game, your first encounter against Judith. You write, so she wins this technical endgame, and you write, in hindsight, but only in hindsight, I look with great admiration at the flawless accuracy, effectivity, and directness Judith demonstrated in this game, which reminds me of Fischer's play. Yeah. She didn't seem to think it was anything special, which made it even worse for me.
Yes.
But at the time, it was a horrible experience to be swept off the board by a 13-year-old girl, even though I knew very well that I wasn't the only one.
Yeah. It was. Yeah.
And I think it's hard. And I think for younger listeners, like, prodigies, in a sense, are a dime a dozen now. You know, they're amazing still, and they're getting better every year, but they're coming so fast and furious that I think it's hard to understand how far ahead the Polgars were of their younger contemporaries.
Yes, I think they were probably the first. So now it is Sorry? Please go on.
No, go ahead. Oh, I was just going to say, and the fact that they were girls, like shifting the paradigm in that sense as well, makes it even more incredible.
Yeah. It was a shock. It was a real shock for everybody who at that time was an established strong player. We all had to deal with it. And I think I was not the only one at all who just couldn't cope with this sensational change of everything that you had been used to. Exactly as you say, they being girls, not boys, made it even more difficult, much more difficult to adjust to having them as an opponent. It was a great time. It was a really great time.
Yeah. And then, of course, again, you played so many... Go ahead.
Yeah. Now, I was going to mention one other great player that I played quite often against.
Go ahead. Let's see if it's the same one I was going to ask you about.
Gotchnoy?
Yeah, go ahead.
Gotchnoy?
You read my mind. Yeah. Okay. I mean, I have others too, but that was the next one.
Yeah. Yeah, I think I played 8 games or so against Gotchnoy. We never drew. I won 3, he won 5. The last game I played against him was in Antwerp, Belgium in 1997, when Gotchnoy was already 61 years of age, far older than any other elite grandmaster already at the time. And at that time, the score between us was 4-3 in his favor. And I was completely set on equalizing the score in that game. I thought, okay, today I'm going to win, and then our score will probably remain at 4-4 forever. But although I got a very good, even winning position, at one point he was down on time to his last minute, but he exuded this will to not lose, to win, to beat me, which actually felt like hatred. It was a very strong emotion which he managed to convey to me, an emotion that he was not going to let this game go. And I was sort of beaten by it. I don't know what happened. I suppose we need neuroscientists to explain this, but this emotion which I felt coming across the board towards me, it was just too strong for me, and I collapsed and lost that game too. Yeah. So that was very interesting. It taught me that even at this age, 61, now I'm actually older than 61 right now, but I still remember... still at 61, you're not supposed to be that good anymore. It shows you that you can maintain a very, very high level, but at a cost, I think. As a human being, I think you, Gotchnoy, suffered from still being such an ambitious player who... I think he remained an exceptional chess player, but as a human being, I suppose he suffered for it. Anyway, he was one of the most colorful players I ever played against, and it was always a joy to meet him.
Yeah, and getting back to that idea of playing like you don't want the game to end. Mm-hmm. It sounds like when you last played him in 97, even at age 61, he had that mindset in spades. And that was the period where you were already starting to grapple with waning
definitely.
Tenacity.
Yes. Yeah, it seemed like he...
I'm more on your side, unfortunately.
Okay, yeah. But by the way, this was quite exceptional. I think I've never felt this emotion from any other player. Gotchnoy,
I've heard Kasparov described that way. You didn't play Kasparov, right?
No, I never played Kasparov, unfortunately. No.
Okay. But I suppose, he's the one where I've heard about this.
Yeah, I suppose he might have this will to win, or at least not to lose, but practically a will to win. Perhaps in the same respect as Gotchnoy. But then Kasparov stopped at a very relatively young age, a bit my age, I think. What was he? He must have been also like 40-something. So he never went all the way.
I think a few years younger, yeah.
Yeah, he never went all the way like Viktor Gotchnoy did. So to still have this power at the age of 61, I think that is absolutely unique to Viktor Gotchnoy.
Yeah, younger than 45, to clarify, not younger than 40. And did you do any postmortems with Viktor?
Oh, yes, yes, yes. Not always, but quite often. And he always enjoyed postmortems very much and was very creative in finding alternatives, better solutions, suggestions. I think he enjoyed postmortems enormously. Could go on forever, indefinitely. He very often just kept analyzing with me and with other players until they shut down the building or something. They threw him out. He couldn't stop. He was a great one for postmortems and other moments of analyzing the game. I had a very creative mind, you know, very creative. Was never happy until he had really exhausted a position.
Yeah, again, speaks to why he had such longevity.
Yeah.
And you also write about your many encounters with a fellow Dutch legend, Jan Timman, and you write that he had, like, he was a stronger player than you, but he had an even better score than he should have based on rating. Why do you think that was?
I think because he was my first idol as a young player. He is about 5 years older than me. So when I started playing chess, when I started getting to know the chess world a little bit, he was already an established young star. So I think he became my idol from a very young age. And I was never able to shake off that mentality of playing against your idol. So we never played on an equal footing mentally. I was always looking up to him, even when we, for a short period of time, had about the same rating and weren't so very different in playing level. But I could never shake that off. No, not until after I stopped playing chess. So I just mentioned that in 2010, I started playing club matches again. And in these club matches, I played two games against Jan Timman as well. And then I was completely free. I had finally lost that idol admiring mentality, and then I could just play against him all out with no mental barriers.
That's fascinating psychologically.
Yes, it is. Yes, it's amazing. It amazed myself at the time that I was sitting opposite. There I was sitting opposite my old nemesis, Jan Timman, and I didn't feel any negativity at all. I just enjoyed those two games. I lost one and I won one. But it was completely on equal terms, like it had never been before. Yeah.
And another player you mentioned who's already come up, equally renowned as a writer these days, Jenna Sosanko, but I was really struck by, you mentioned the depth of his opening preparation, and especially, I believe it was the Catalan, the toughness of cracking his Catalan. What was it like to play him so many times and feel like you have to get out of the opening okay in those battles?
Yes, yes. Yes, it was a very daunting prospect to play against him, but very different from playing Jan Timman. It was just that he was so strong. When I was young, he was already a world-class player, and he was just such a strong opening expert, but also a strong player generally. So I think he was one of those people who really forced me to become better myself. I played him so often that every time when I was young, I felt that I simply had to play better than I could, if that is a possibility. He forced me. He was one of those, maybe he was the player who I should credit most with forcing me to become a better player myself. And he was such a power at the chessboard.
And what did you do? Like, how did that manifest? What did you do to get better?
I think what I did was take these games against him as seriously as I could and sort of do everything a little bit better than I thought I could do them. By the way, he was also a player who I observed becoming weaker at a certain age. Again, I kept playing professionally until he was about 50, I think, maybe a little bit longer than that. And in his last years as a professional chess player, I could just feel his decline. He was just becoming weaker and weaker. I mean, he never dropped, of course, to a really weak level. He still remained a grandmaster. But yes, I could feel that he was probably, he has meant a lot to me. Actually, now that we are talking about him, perhaps I realized this for the first time, that he really meant a lot to me. And that he was also the first player who I noticed the inevitability of decline in a chess player. I just observed it in him first. And a few years after that, I started observing the same symptoms in myself. I recognized the symptoms because I had already observed them in Sezonko.
Did you ever discuss it with him?
No, I've never discussed these things with anybody. I could write about them, but I never discussed these things. And even after I published my book, Zwartebit, in Dutch in 2010, none of my old colleagues came up to me and discussed what I had written about them. Chess players just don't do that. They talk about what's wrong with the Grünfeld, but not about what's wrong with themselves.
Right. And you told a funny story about Sezonko, the 1988 Olympiad involving a draw offer to the Soviet team. Yeah. Could we hear that story?
Well, in 1988, the Dutch played a very good Olympiad. After, I think, 5 or 6 rounds, we were paired with what was still the Soviet Union at the time. Of course, the top favorite for winning the Olympiad. Genna played a fairly short draw that day against Artur Yusupov and then started watching the other games. And at some point, he decided that, well, we're not doing that badly, actually. Maybe we should propose a draw, 2-2, 4 draws, which was at that time was quite common to do in team events. It wasn't considered unsporting or anything. So he approached our own captain and said, well, what do you think, captain, about offering a 2-2? And the captain said, well, yes, but this is the Soviet Union we're dealing with. Surely they're not going to accept. And so Genna, well, you never know. And he just went to the Soviet captain, which I think was Makarichev, also a famous grandmaster, well-known grandmaster, and proposed it to him. And Makarichev was clearly surprised, felt that this was perhaps a little too big a decision to make by himself. So he said, okay, reasonable, but I have to consult Kasparov on this. Kasparov was not playing that day. Karpov was board one. And then Kasparov was consulted. He looked at the boards, the games, and his judgment was extremely negative for his own fellow team members. He looked at Karpov first, Karpov versus Van der Wiel. Karpov, bad position, bad. Then went over to, I think, Ivanchuk. Remember, this is still the Soviet Union, so not just Russian players, but from all over that country. Ivanchuk versus Rynnikhaev, I think, had just sacrificed a piece. Looks very, very, very suspect. The last game was, I think, Piquet against... I'm not quite sure. I'm not quite sure whom Piquet was playing against. A similar comment, and he said, yes, okay, 2-2. And Makarchev, who had to make the official decision, was still hesitant. Clearly, this had never happened to him before. And then Sosonko decided to stop the clocks himself. And then there was no going back for Makarchev and... the arbiters who had been completely kept outside all these negotiations simply stopped the other clocks and the match was over. But this was just so unusual and unique it is a real story. It is a real story within the greater story of that Olympiad. It was something that never happened again, I think, that a player stops the clocks and this is accepted by all and it's the end of the game.
Yeah. Did anyone even look at him funny or he just got away with it?
I think the Dutch players were all a bit surprised, but they were all very happy to accept. The Soviet players, I think, they all had the attitude of hierarchy. They just looked at their captain and said, well, this is for you to decide. Doesn't matter to me, or it's not my decision. It's your decision. And that's what happened. So they all accepted. I think afterwards, Ivanchuk protested that he wasn't actually losing, as Kasparov thought. He was actually, his opponent just made a mistake and he was probably winning. But that was a feeble protest because it didn't count for anything against what Kasparov and Makarchev had already decided.
Yeah, Ivanchuk, he must have been... He was pretty young, right?
Yeah, it was 88, so he was probably 18 or 19, yes. Yeah.
So well, you played him when he was pretty young too, right?
Yeah.
Right, no authority.
I played him only once, I think. This was in 94 in Munich. Yeah, a draw.
And you also played Mikhail Tal just once, is that right?
Also just once, yes, towards the end of his career, of his life, actually. Also in the Wijkaanzee tournament in 1988. Yes, I think 1988, yes. Yeah, my memory is beginning to fade a little bit. There was a time when I was absolutely flawless about dates and years and names, but now I have become a little bit hesitant.
Had to think about it.
Yes,
yeah. that's okay. You're doing quite all right. We'll be right back with more from Grandmaster Paul van der Steuren. And we are back. Any other favorite stories from all of your years competing with these giants?
Well, a lot of things happened, of course. But I think in hindsight, what happened to me when I played Viktor Korchnoi in Wijkaanzee in 1978 was probably my favorite story. It was... a game where I got into such a deep concentration that I completely dropped my normal level, playing level, and managed to play the whole game at a much higher level than I had ever been able to do before that, and kept my concentration not only during the session, but in those days we still adjourned games. So we played 5 hours, 40 moves, 5 hours, then adjourned, had a break of a 2 hour break, and then continued the game. So I had to keep my concentration in total for at least 9 hours, probably more. And this I did. It was never broken, not for a single moment. And that has been such a strange experience that I still look back on it as the most remarkable moment of my entire chess life, that I was able to keep that incredibly deep concentration for such a long time.
So you describe it in the book. It almost comes across as like an out of body experience.
Yeah, it almost was. Yes. Yeah, I think it was very close to that. Yes.
And especially, you never had that feeling in another game?
No, never. Sometimes you got close to it, perhaps, but that was a truly unique experience. So this is not like an anecdote. It's just like a very impressive moment in my life. It's a moment when chess somehow took control of me instead of me trying to take control of chess. Yeah, I can only talk about it in spiritual or mystic terms. There's no rational explanation that I know of that this could happen to me at the time.
That's the beauty of life, one of the mysteries of life, that someone can have an experience like that.
Yes, that a thing like that can happen to you.
And yeah. And this has been amazing conversation, as I expected, based on your book, Paul. And the last major topic I wanted to touch on is your work at the Max Oehre Center there in the Netherlands. I haven't been to the Netherlands since the mid-2000s, but I remember being struck by the chess culture there, and particularly being struck by the big chess set right in Max Oehre Square. And I unfortunately didn't visit the chess center nearby, but for some listeners will have been there, some wouldn't. But could you describe your work at the chess center?
Well, I'm the chairman, and we work with volunteers almost entirely. And what we do is keep a chess center alive, which offers people the chance to visit our museum. The Max Oehre Museum celebrates the life of Max Oehre, the only Dutch player who managed to become world champion. This is in the 1930s. So we have a very nice museum, which is very popular with tourists, actually. And we also have a chess center with a library and other study facilities, and you can play there. And we organize small events now and again. It's probably the only, let's say, chess center in the Netherlands, and there are not too many places like that anywhere, I think. We survive almost solely on donations, so it's in fact, it's quite incredible that we exist at all. But we do exist already for 35 years now. And we have recently moved to another location in the same building, which has cost us a lot of money. And we set up a crowdfunding, which again showed how many people support chess and the Max Oehre Center in particular in the Netherlands and even abroad, because we have already acquired about 15,000 euros from that chess world. So we are really sort of rooted in chess culture in Holland.
Yeah, I mean, obviously, I've interviewed so many. I mean, the Dutch legacy in chess is immense. And obviously, I've interviewed so many Dutch players. And honestly, it's a little surprising there's only been one world champion, because there's so many incredible players, and so many Dutch players have contributed so much to the game.
Mm. Well, after all,
I will definitely be contributing.
Thank you.
Go ahead.
Well, yes, we've had only one world champion, but we have come close with Jan Timman, who has been the world number two for quite a few years, actually, before Kasparov took control of the chess world. And recently, of course, we have also Anish Giri, who is also very, very close to the level of Carlsen, and he has been very close to securing a match for the world championship. So, yeah, I think for a small country, we're doing okay. It's to have more than we have already have would perhaps be a little bit arrogant.
Yeah, and especially during the Soviet era, it was basically, it was almost impossible for a non-Soviet. I mean, obviously, Fischer and Ure pulled it off, but it was very difficult for anyone from outside of the Soviet Union to win.
Yeah.
And I was obviously, like all Dutch chess fans, saddened that Anish didn't make it into this candidates, because could have been his year.
It would have been wonderful.
Would have been... Yeah, it would have been fun.
It would have been wonderful.
And how do you assess the Dutch chess scene now here in the U.S.? There's the professional element, but there's also just chess seems more popular than ever here in the United States. I'm curious, in the Netherlands, I sort of have a feeling what you'll say about the professional level, but I'm also curious at an amateur level what you see in terms of chess's popularity.
Yeah, I think it's very similar to the U.S. actually. Chess has benefited enormously from the rise of online chess. In Holland, online chess has also become all the rage. In fact, chess is enormously popular with children of primary school age, and youth clubs are simply overflowing with kids who want to become more involved with chess. It's very, very popular at the moment. We are really experiencing a huge wave of popularity. Unfortunately, this is not yet reflected in more sponsorship, in more tournaments. So I'm not quite sure where this popularity is going, but yes, we do see an immense rise in chess, in interest in chess. Also, thanks to Beth Harmon, I think, and the Queen's Gambit, they have also done very, very much for chess in Holland as well.
Good to hear. Yeah, it's definitely the same here in the U.S. Yeah. Well, I encourage listeners to support the Max Irwe Center if they are able to. I will make a donation when we say goodbye, which I think will be shortly. Unless you have, do you have any other major topics you'd like to discuss, Paul?
Well, I think we've covered a wide field, haven't we? No,
we have. I mean, there's so much in your book. There's
Well, I would just like to say hello to everybody in America, in the U.S., who loves chess. And I would certainly advise everybody to keep on loving chess and to just be involved with chess in a way that makes you happy with it. So for me personally, this has become being a spectator rather than a player myself. And of course, if you're younger, then I would simply love to see all of you become good players. Better players.
Great advice. Yeah. And excellent advice. Yeah. It's that's a lot of what this podcast is about, is we know we love chess, but where does it fit within our lives? And that's in a sense what your book is about too, the evolving, I'm referring to In Black and White and Mindful Chess for that matter, but sort of how chess as a companion, one's relationship to it just as any relationship can evolve over life. And the idea of acceptance, that's not a bad thing. That's just the cycles of life as it comes. So the book is called Chess and is called In Black and White. Couldn't recommend it more highly. And Mindful Chess as well is a very fun read, especially if you're interested in sort of philosophy and Zen ideas and considering mindfulness. I highly recommend both books, and I'll link to where to get them. Oh, I know we were saying goodbye, but we actually didn't discuss fundamental chess openings, Paul.
Oh, okay.
Could we discuss that for a few more minutes?
Yeah, sure. Yeah.
So, because as I was starting to tell you before we recorded, it's a rare, you know, I grew up with these chess encyclopedias, but they were just moves for the most part. But yours is this rare book that you could tell, you know, a 1400 player or someone, you know, firmly amateur level, that you want to know what the opening moves are, but you need to understand ideas too. And this was kind of the only book that really explained the ideas of every opening. So you were saying that even today, this book still sells pretty well?
Yes, it does. And thank you for your kind words. I agree that at the time of writing, this was a fairly unique book in that I just explain opening theory starting from move one and not going too deeply, not becoming really involved with fashionable variations or with subtleties. I just want to explain how opening theory as a whole is a body which simply starts at the start of the game, and that you don't have to be frightened of it. So also it's encyclopedic, so I'm trying to simply present all the accepted possibilities starting from move one. And yes, at the time of writing, this was a completely new concept. I think since then there have been a few books more or less similar. Yes, it's been a tremendous success. I'm completely surprised by it myself. But the book is still selling well, even though it's by now about 20 years old. It simply doesn't age very much, because I do not go into the subtleties of what current theory is exploring. I simply present the openings and explain the reasons why they exist.
Yeah, it's only $10 on Kindle. And yeah, it's just a really useful book to have around, because if you come across some new opening and you're a little unclear on like what the driving principles are, as you say, it's not so much about the theory. You can just look and you have very lucid explanations. Any chance of an update of that book, Paul?
I think I proposed the idea about 10 years ago to my Dutch publisher and they didn't want to do it. But maybe by now it should be done at least in the English language. Yes. Yeah, it's a very good suggestion. Yeah. I haven't been thinking about that for some time. But yes, I think an update in the English language would be very good.
Yeah. Okay, so we'll leave you, Paul, with two books to write. You've got to update FCO, you've got to write a book about sports psychology and chess. But so we've got some homework for you. But I would love to discuss those things and to chat again sometime. But I want to thank you for your time, Paul, and for your wonderful books.
Thank you, Ben, for talking to me, and good luck with your Perpetual Chess podcast, which is a great idea.
Podcast Network.